Welcome to the April 16th, 2018 meeting of the Delta Stewardship Council. I'd like to call this meeting to order and begin with the roll call, beginning with Council Member Weinberg, who is?
Here, present.
Demro here.
Tatayan here.
Fiorini here.
Maronian here.
Thompson here.
We have a quorum. We expect Assembly Member Gatto to be joining us soon. As I mentioned at the last meeting, Senate Pro Tem De Leon had announced the newest member of the council, formerly in a position that was formerly held by Senator Patrick Johnston. It's my pleasure to introduce you to Maria Maronian, who is the managing partner and chief financial officer of the Cordoba Corporation, a Los Angeles-based full-service engineering, construction management, and program management firm with a statewide portfolio and presence specializing in transportation, water, energy, education, and facilities projects. Maria is directly responsible for the firm's strategic financial planning and operations, overseeing the company's statewide financial operations. Maria holds a Master's of Urban and Regional Planning from the University of California, Los Angeles. Formerly chairing the Los Angeles Regional Water Quality Control Board, Maria led the board in adopting the region's landmark MS4 permit. She participates in numerous water policy panels on water quality and supply issues and serves as a guest lecturer for universities throughout the state. Maria serves in leadership positions for several educational institutions and nonprofit organizations. She is the vice chair of the Board of Trustees at Woodbury University, is a member of the Dean's Leadership Board at Cal Poly Pomona, not San Luis Obispo, I'm sorry, College of Engineering, and is a member of the Board of Trustees at Southwestern Law School. In addition, Maria is the international chairperson of the Armenian Fund, and which has raised more than $120 million for humanitarian and infrastructure development in Armenia. Maria, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I'm looking forward to working with everybody. Thank you for having me. Looking forward to working with the board members. I know that you are all very accomplished and knowledgeable individuals here and have done a great job, and I'm also looking forward to work with the stakeholders and understanding that it's such a pivotal time in the life of the Delta and water and our state, not only in terms of the region, but also stakeholders immediately in the area. So thank you.
Thank you. Great to have you with us. Before we move to agenda item 3, I have a few important housekeeping items to share with you. Restrooms can be found by exiting out the main doors, turn left, and then left again. Down the hallway, they will be on your left. So left, left, left. The water fountains are in the same location. During an emergency exit, we must follow the DGS fire exit procedures. You will exit out the main doors at the back of this room, the same doors you entered through. When you reach the grand lobby, go to your right and proceed out the glass doors leading to the back of the building and a river walk. Wait there for further instructions. A DGS employee will be there to greet you. No food or drinks are allowed in the auditorium. And if you decide to exit the back glass doors towards the river walk, you will need to walk all the way around the building to get in, so be cautious during break times. For those that parked in the parking structure, the guest exit is on the north side. Using cash is faster, although they do take credit and debit cards. The request to comment slips are on the front table. If you would like to make provide comments, Lita will be circulating to collect completed cards, and we'll also have some blank cards to furnish you. Now would be a good time to put your cell phones on silent, and for Wi-Fi use, the username is DGS Guest. So I think that's all the housekeeping items that I had to cover. So now, turning to agenda item number 3, Delta Plan amendments for Delta Levee's investment strategy, conveyance storage systems, and the operation of both, and performance measures. We are here today after years and years of work to consider the proposed Delta Plan amendments and the accompanying final environmental impact report. We will start with the staff presentation and recommendations, then hear public comments, followed by council deliberation. If you wish to provide public comments, we'll ask you to fill out the blue request to speak card at this time. To my colleagues on the council, please hold questions to staff until we've heard the staff complete their presentations. I think that covers all of the logistics. So with that, I'd like to call on Jessica Law, our acting executive officer, to introduce the presenters for agenda item number 3.
Thank you, Chair Fiorini. I'd like to call up our Deputy Executive Officer for Planning and Performance, Jeff Henderson, to introduce the presentation and the panel and the speakers. Thanks.
All right. Good morning, Council members. Thank you for having us in today to talk about the amendments to the Delta Plan. Agenda Item 3, as part of this agenda item today, the Council will consider approval of 3 Delta Plan amendments that would amend the content of Chapters 3 and 7, as well as Appendix E of the Delta Plan, which is the state's comprehensive plan for the Delta to achieve the co-equal goals. As Randy mentioned, this effort represents culmination of several years of staff and consultant efforts to prepare amendments, to seek stakeholder and public input, and to conduct environmental analysis on the amendments. The amendments that we're considering today are the Delta Levee's Investment and Risk Reduction Strategy, otherwise known as the DLIS amendment, to Chapter 7 of the Delta Plan, the Conveyance, Storage, and Operations of Both amendment, which is otherwise known as the CSO amendment, which is to Chapter 3 of the Delta Plan, and various amendments to performance measures, which are contained in Appendix E of the Delta Plan. We refer to these typically as the PM amendments. These amendments are for consideration today. We're also prepared a program environmental impact report, which the council will receive a report on as part of our presentation today. And our goal for today is to present the staff report, to receive public comments on the proposed amendments and the program environmental impact report. And following council deliberation, we recommend adoption of a resolution that's attached to your staff report. I want to take a moment and just introduce the staff that is going to be presenting to the council today, as well as to acknowledge some of the efforts of our consulting team. Aaron Mullen, Senior Water Resources Engineer with the council, and Ryan Stanbro, our Legislative and Policy Advisor, will be presenting on the DLIS amendment. Carrie Shively, a Vice President at Stantec, will be presenting on the CSO amendment. Martina Kohler, Program Manager for Performance Management, will be presenting on the performance measures. And Ellen Garber, an attorney with Shute, Mahaly, and Weinberger, will be presenting on our CEQA process. I also want to acknowledge that the council received several letters from members of the public regarding the amendments since the packets were first distributed last week. I want to acknowledge 5 letters, one from the state water contractors and the San Luis and Delta Mendota Water Authority and the Westlands Water District, another letter from Saluhi Meserve on behalf of the local agencies of the North Delta, a third letter from Friends of the River and Associated Public Interest Organizations, a letter from the law offices of Stephen Volker on behalf of the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations, the Institute for Fisheries Resources, San Francisco Crab Boat Owners Association, and the North Coast Rivers Alliance, and a letter from Somich, Simmons, and Dunn on behalf of the City of Stockton. These letters have been provided to council members and will be posted to the website following our meeting. So the Delta Plan was first adopted in 2013. It's been amended twice to date, And per statute, the council has the authority to revise the plan as it deems appropriate. As mentioned previously, this project would revise the DLIS, the CSO, and the PM components of the plan. Due to changed circumstances and conditions in the Delta, as well as prior commitments that were made in the 2013 Delta plan. And we'd like to note that this amendment is wholly separate from the future ecosystem amendment to the Delta plan, which is in the current planning stages, as well as the upcoming five-year Delta plan review that the council will receive reports on in May and December of this year. A bit about our process to date. The council has considered language for these three amendments on numerous prior occasions, most notably in June of 2017, when the council essentially approved the amendments for purposes of environmental review. And as part of deliberations that occurred at that time, the council directed the staff to conduct the CEQA analysis to allow for policy RRP1, which relates to the Delta Levees investment strategy, to be either a recommendation or a regulatory policy. And that decision is before the council today. These plan amendments are a project under the California Environmental Quality Act, which essentially obligates the council to analyze and disclose the potential environmental effects associated with adopting and implementing the amendments. To do that, the council's prepared a program environmental impact report to provide for public disclosure of those significant environmental effects and to foster informed decision-making by the council. So our key action today is certification of the PEIR, which would enable the council then to take action relative to the Delta Plan amendments. And the staff report before you provides an overview of each of the amendments. Additional details for each amendment are provided as appendices to the resolution and the final program EIR. I would also like to note that there are several appendices that accompany both the EIR and the resolution, and these include the complete text of the amended chapters 3 and 7, as well as Appendix E of the Delta Plan. Many of the changes there are shown in track changes, so it is a rather lengthy appendix, but the changes that are noted within those appendices are relatively short. So at this time, I'll ask our staff to provide summaries of the general content and process, modifications to the amendments since June 2017, and our staff recommendation regarding policy RRP1, beginning with Aaron and Ryan, who will cover the DLIS amendment.
Good morning. Hope everybody's well today. I am going to briefly touch on the Delta Levee strategy, its development, prior approvals, and Ryan Stamper will discuss where we are today. As you know, the current investment strategy, or RRP1, was adopted with the Delta Plan in 2013. It was meant to be an interim policy until the council could develop a more detailed and thorough methodology. The Delta Levee Investment Strategy, or DLIS, was developed over 2.5 years. We started with objectives to reduce flood risk in the Delta with cost-effective investments that further the co-equal goals. From objectives, we developed 12 principles, which included ideas like expenditure should reduce risk and urban areas are priority. We combined the objectives and principles with outreach that consisted of 40 meetings with technical experts, including district engineers, 4 public workshops, and 27 council discussions to develop what would become the proposed Chapter 7 amendment, which the council approved in March 2017. Next slide. As I mentioned in the previous slide, the Chapter 7 amendment was approved as a project description at the March 7, 2017 council meeting. DLIS was before the council again in June of 2017 when the MOU between the council, the flood board, and DWR was conceptually approved. At the same meeting, the DLIS project description was amended to provide the option of adopting the prioritization as either a regulation or a recommendation. And last month, the council was briefed on the progress of the MOU working group that was made in response to the MOU's signature in September of 2017. I'm not going to spend much time on the activities of the working group since the council was briefed on it last month, but I am going to go over the highlights. Since the working group began meeting in November of 2017, we have made significant progress towards meeting the goals outlined in the MOU's joint implementation plan, including a way forward on jointly managing the D-list tool, a way to incorporate the prioritization into DWR's PSP process, a framework for reporting and tracking, and progress towards ability to pay methodology. I'm now going to hand this over to Ryan, who's going to talk about the two options before the council today.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. For the record, Ryan Stammer, Legislative and Policy Advisor at the Council. So as Jeff mentioned, the D-list portion of the staff report lays out two options for Council consideration, each of which provides a series of opportunities as well as some challenges. The first option is to adopt D-list as a recommendation. Under this approach, revising the priorities would likely be less cumbersome from an administrative perspective, because a rulemaking package through the Office of Administrative Law would likely not be required. That said, a recommendation does rely on the ongoing and willing participation of the MOU signatories and would result in a reduction of the Council's regulatory authority over Delta flood management investments, since this recommendation would replace the Council's existing regulatory policy, RRP1. Next slide. The second option before the Council is to adopt D-list as a regulation, which would revise the existing policy to include the prioritization. This approach would be legally enforceable and therefore provide greater accountability for compliance with the prioritization. However, future revisions to the prioritization could require significant administrative effort along the lines of a Delta Plan amendment, associated environmental review, as well as a rulemaking package. In the staff recommendation, as articulated in the staff report before you, is for the Council to adopt the D-list prioritization as a regulation. And that concludes my portion. I'll turn it over now to Carrie.
Good morning, Chairman Fiorini and Council members. I'm going to review the conveyance, storage, and operation of both amendment, or the CSO amendment. This comprises changes to Chapter 3 of the Delta Plan. That chapter is titled A More Reliable Water Supply for California. Chapter 3 includes a recommendation, WRR 12, that recommended that the state and federal agencies complete the Bay Delta Conservation Plan by December of 2014. Had this recommendation been fulfilled, the BDCP's conveyance provisions would have been automatically incorporated into the Delta Plan, pursuant to Water Code Section 85320A. The 2013 Delta Plan also included in Appendix A a provision that should the BDCP process not be completed by January of 2016, the Council would revisit the issue of conveyance and determine whether it could take some actions to facilitate improved conveyance facilities within the Delta and without the BDCP in place. In 2015, the state did announce that it would not pursue and complete a BDCP as a natural community conservation plan and habitat conservation plan, and instead would pursue California Water Fix, as well as a parallel effort, California Eco Restore. So these actions prompted the Council to review the issue of conveyance, storage, and water operations in the Delta as provided for in Water Code Section 85304. I'll go over a little bit the process for developing the CSO amendment. In 2015, the Council hosted panels of experts and stakeholders to discuss issues related to conveyance and storage. And in November of 2015, the Council adopted a problem statement and 19 principles for water conveyance in the Delta, storage systems, and for the operation of both to achieve the co-equal goals. Throughout 2016, the Council discussed and provided additional guidance and direction to staff regarding the scope and content of the CSO amendment. In its March, June, and September meetings, it also heard briefings from the Department of Water Resources and the California Water Commission related to their efforts and initiatives that addressed storage and conveyance. In February of 2017, an initial discussion draft of the CSO amendment was presented to the Council by staff, and three public workshops were held the following month in March of 2017. In April and May, additional revised drafts of the CSO amendment were again presented to Council for their consideration and discussion. And in June of 2017, the Council approved the draft CSO amendment for use as the project description for the purposes of CEQA. So the CSO amendment replaces Delta Plan Recommendation WRR-12. This is the recommendation that called for completion of the Bay Delta Conservation Plan. It replaces this recommendation in its entirety with a series of 11 proposed recommendations that promote options for water conveyance, storage systems, and the operation of both. These are listed in your packets and can be seen in the revised recommendations section of Chapter 3, which is an attachment to your packet. The CSO amendment promotes options for new and improved conveyance through the Delta and storage and other storage systems in the Delta watershed. In doing so, it describes the characteristics of Delta conveyance projects and storage projects and their operations, characteristics that staff believe could best contribute to achieving the co-equal goals consistent with the direction provided in the Delta Reform Act. The recommendations do not promote specific projects, such as WaterFix, nor do they include details related to project size, configuration, design, etc. The remaining introduction and problem statement portions of the CSO amendment, which Council and others provided many comments on, are also incorporated into the narrative portion of Chapter 3. So several changes have been made to the CSO amendment since it was adopted in June for the purpose of the PEIR. These include changes that align with responses to comments that were received from the Delta Independent Science Board, who reviewed the CSO amendment, as well as public comment received through the PEIR process. These changes included some typographical corrections and minor grammatical changes, additional bibliographic citations that were added to the introduction and problem statement text. Edits were also made to add stronger or lesser emphasis to different portions of the text. I've included some of those examples here, and they're also in your packets, but they primarily involve changes to wording and terminology, such as using the word essential as opposed to critical. Edits were also made similar to those for greater or lesser emphasis to add clarity and improve understanding of the text. Similar to those for greater and lesser emphasis, these changes applied primarily to the introduction and problem statement portion of the amendment, not to the recommendations themselves. And we also received one non-substantive edit to amended text of Chapter 3 as part of the public comment process for the PEIR. This comment resulted in the removal of a reference to completion of the BDCP, which had appeared in the problem statement for recommendation WRR-12 in Chapter 3. Again, this change did not affect the analysis of environmental effects in the PEIR. It merely removed text that was no longer needed. So the revised amendment is included as Exhibit 4 to the staff report, and a redlined version of the chapter appears as Attachment A3 to Appendix A of the final PEIR. Thank you.
Good morning. I will be talking about the performance measures. The Delta Plan includes performance measures to measure progress in achieving its objectives. The Council consolidated all the performance measures into the Appendix E of the Delta Plan in 2016. After that, refinements on performance measures focus on the output and outcome measures. These refinements were based on emerging science, feedback received during the public workshop and public comment period, review and comments from external subject matter experts, input from the Delta's lead scientist and the Delta Science Program, as well as input from council members. Delta Independent Science Board provided a comment letter on the performance measures in February 2017. Each performance measure has an associated detailed data sheet. These data sheets are not part of the Appendix E. The data sheet is a compilation of the supporting science and includes the basis for selection, expectation for each measure, data sources, assessment methodology, and key references. Responses to public comments on the draft PEIR include non-substantive edits to the performance measure language in Appendix E, as well as to the performance measure data sheets. So edits to the Appendix E include these three measures. For the two submeasures under the performance measure 4.2, it's peak flows and more gradual recession flows at the end of wet season. It includes edit location specifics to make it clear that the metric and the target applies to the Benbridge gauge station on the Sacramento River. And the third one is adding a clarifying detail to the target of PM6.9, measurable toxicity. The target is less than 1% toxicity in sediment samples from pesticides and other contaminants using invertebrates testing by 2034. In addition, non-substantive technical edits were made to the performance measure data sheets. There is a list on the slide, and details are in the staff report. I will summarize that these include edits that are based on the PEIR analysis and responses to public comments, and includes use of additional best available science, adding key recent references, some clarifying details, and adding linkages to recent relevant ongoing efforts. So now I will turn to Andrew, who will continue with performance measures.
Thank you, Martina. Members of the council, Andrew Tarjanen, staff attorney for the council. The performance measures and the accompanying data sheets include two small categories of changes that aren't in response to public comments. They're legal directive changes, mostly to clarify language, and these changes are listed in performance measures 3.1, 3.2, and 3.4. And there's two categories of changes. The first is to clarify that the performance measures apply to urban water suppliers within the Delta or those relying on water from the Delta watershed. That was some language that I believe was in some of the other performance measures, and we, for clarification purposes, legal added those to performance measures 3.1, 3.2, and 3.4. The second category of changes is a legal clarification. These three performance measures referenced in regards to urban water management plans, they referenced water contractors and on one occasion water diverters, in addition to urban water suppliers. Urban water suppliers is a defined term in the water code, and they're who prepares urban water management plans. Water contractors and water diverters are not defined in the water code, at least not in the way, not respective to urban water management plans. So this change in particular alleviates some potential confusion that could arise from the multiple terms and the two that were imprecisely defined. These same changes, the language changes, were also carried into the data sheets for these three performance measures. The final EIR has the red line version in Appendix A to that final EIR, and your resolution packet has the clean version of the clean non-red light version of Appendix E, which is the performance measures plus the data sheets. And that's all for the legal.
And I'll ask Ellen Garber to come and summarize the environmental review process.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the council. Ellen Garber with Schumacher and Weinberger. I will talk about, as Jeff said, the environmental review process. As you know, the project consists of amendments to the Delta Plan, and the Delta Plan was approved in 2013 based on a programmatic EIR, as was appropriate for a plan-level document. So accordingly, to amend the Delta Plan, we are doing a plan-level document, or did one as well, which is also a programmatic EIR. The council published a notice of preparation in March. There was a scoping meeting during the scoping period to receive comments. The draft EIR was published, and now we have a final EIR, and those two documents, a draft and final, make up the programmatic EIR. The draft EIR describes the Delta Plan amendments and the project objectives. It also describes the potential activities and projects by other agencies that these agencies may or are likely to undertake in response to these amendments. It analyzes the significant environmental effects of those actions, and it conservatively assumes that all of the provisions of these amendments, whether recommendations or policies, will achieve their desired effect and therefore analyzes the impact of that full response to the Delta Plan amendments. The draft EIR, or the EIR, also identifies mitigation measures and considers alternatives, both to reduce significant impacts. In 2013, all of the mitigation measures that were identified in the Delta Plan programmatic EIR were adopted and incorporated into the Delta Plan, so they don't need to be readopted. They're required to be implemented through policy GP1. This programmatic EIR identifies one new mitigation measure having to do with glare in the aesthetics, the visual section. Staff recommends that the council revise policy GP1B2, and this is covered on page 15 of the staff report, in order to clarify that any new mitigation measures adopted by the council would also be required to be implemented by covered actions, because this is ambiguous right now in the current version of GP1. As I said, and as required by CEQA, the PEIR analyzes alternatives, the mandatory no project alternative, and three alternatives of different emphasis. One emphasizes reduced reliance on the Delta by increasing water storage and conveyance outside of the Delta. And these, I'm giving very short summaries, by the way, and we can respond, or staff too, if you want greater detail. The second, which is the environmentally superior alternative, emphasizes Delta wetland restoration. And the third emphasizes through Delta conveyance. In addition to these three, 10 other alternatives were considered in the EIR, discussed in section 9.2.3, and then rejected for further analysis, for the most part because they either increased impacts or didn't achieve one of the major project objectives. The draft EIR was published in November 2017. It was available for a very long public comment period, 82 days. 3,600 people, approximately, organizations, agencies were notified, and the council received 535 written communications commenting on the EIR. 492 of those were a form letter. Also, as required by CEQA, the final EIR contains responses to every individual comment that raises an environmental issue. In addition, master responses were prepared, because there were certain comments that were repeated throughout the individual comments, and they provide a single response in addition to the individual responses. And these are on the topics of the CSO amendment, including, but not limited to, the relationship to California Water Fix, the DLIS amendment, the performance measures amendment, an explanation of the approach to the environmental analysis, including the use of example projects, such as California Water Fix. The EIR, to aid its analysis, uses substantial evidence from other environmental documents about the types of impacts that we can anticipate for the from the types of projects that might be implemented in response to these amendments, based on work that other agencies have done for their environmental documents. It determines and it discusses, in addition, other topics such as the use of best available science and best available information. Another master response discusses the alternatives, and the last one discusses the authority of the council in general under the Delta Reform Act, and the legal status of the Delta Plan in light of the ongoing Delta Plan litigation. The final EIR includes these responses to comments. It includes text revisions made in response to comments and made by staff, as staff have talked about, to clarify, correct typos, and so forth. The appendices include the full text of chapters 3 and 7 in Appendix E, with the amended language, the language of the amendments in them. That's why they're so voluminous, and all of the data sheets, which were also in the draft EIR, by the way, and shows text, these text revisions that we're talking about. The final EIR was released to the public and made available on April 16th, and responses were sent to public agencies that commented on that date as well. Today, you will be discussing certifying the EIR. CEQA requires that the EIR be certified before you take action on the proposed project. The certification involves certifying that the EIR was prepared in compliance with CEQA, that the council has reviewed and considered the information in the EIR, and that it reflects the independent judgment and analysis of the council. And finally, the approval process, as you will see in the resolution, involves first adopting the CEQA findings, which include a statement of overriding consideration explaining why the benefits of the project outweigh its significant environmental effects, adopts and incorporates into the Delta Plan amendments the new mitigation measure, and adopts the mitigation monitoring and reporting program, which is the enforcement tool for the mitigation measures. And if there are no questions, I will turn it over to Jeff.
Thank you, Ellen. So in summary, the staff recommendation today is that the council adopt the proposed resolution that's provided as attachment 1 to your staff report. The resolution includes a number of related items, and by adopting the resolution, the council would certify the final Delta Plan Amendments FEIR, would adopt findings in the Statement of Overriding Considerations associated with the FEIR, would adopt and incorporate Mitigation Measure 5.2-1 that's proposed in the PEIR into the Delta Plan, would adopt the Mitigation and Monitoring Program, would adopt Delta Plan amendments to Chapter 7 for the DLIS amendment, noting at this point that staff recommends adopting policy RRP1 as a regulation. Would adopt Delta Plan amendments to Chapter 3 for the CSO amendment. Would adopt Delta Plan amendments to Appendix E for the PMs. Would direct council staff to initiate rulemaking, including the modification of policy GP1B2, and would direct the executive officer to correct errata, to complete identified non-substantive changes, and to make changes required by the Office of Administrative Law to complete the rulemaking. And this concludes staff's presentation. We'd be happy to entertain questions from council members. Thank you.
Jeff and other presenters, thank you for that. Any questions from the council before we seek public comment? Skip.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first, let me thank the chair and staff for moving this important item to the front of the agenda before even our closed session. But given that, we're talking about a document of over 2,300 pages that was released to us about a week ago, 6 days ago. It's a lot. And I understand that we've had a lot of outreach to the public, and the public has had an opportunity to weigh in, but there are some changes that could be significant changes. And I think out of fairness to the public, we have one new member. I won't speak for Maria, but we have one new member that hasn't had a chance, I don't think, to look at all the documentation, and she's going to be asked to vote today. So I'm asking that we hold this off for 60 days, come back in our June meeting prepared after we've had an opportunity to read all of the documents, to make an informed decision on voting on these different amendments and the CEQA document. So that would be my ask, Mr. Chair, to postpone it for 60 days. And if you couldn't see 60 days, I would think at least 30 days is an appropriate time. Thank you.
Thank you, Skip. Any other questions for the staff or the presenters? Okay, then let's turn to...
Well, Mr. Chair, then, if I may, I'm going to make a motion that we extend this notice period for 60 days.
All right. Do we have a second on the motion? Okay. Gatto seconds. Discussion on the motion. Would the maker of the motion like to restate the purpose?
Well, the purpose, I think, is obvious, to allow the public, which I believe is who we're working for, to be given the ample time to look at the changes critically. I mean, I wanted staff to make their presentation because I felt it was important that the public at least get a sense of what the changes are. But I think a description given by staff is not like 60 days of really looking at the changes in the document. So my ask would be, based on these changes, we would extend this period for another 60 days to our June meeting.
Okay. You've heard the motion. It's been seconded. Any further discussion? Ken?
Could we just ask outside counsel to come back to the podium? Could you describe the requirements of CEQA for adoption of a final EIR, how long it has to be out in public before a lead agency's body takes action with the items that staff has put in front of us today?
There are no legal requirements for the final EIR to be available before the body takes action. Those requirements, no CEQA requirements, those have to do with the agency's own noticing requirements. The only legal requirement is that public agencies who have commented on the draft EIR are required to receive, to be sent responses to their comments 10 days in advance of the certification. That's the only legal requirement under CEQA.
Thank you.
Any other comments?
I have a question. Is there a chance that Mr. Henderson could explain one more time? I think this was a part of the presentation, but if you could explain one more time the number of workshops and the kind of public outreach that was done and the opportunity that was given to all the stakeholders to provide their input.
Absolutely. A number of public engagement events had occurred throughout 2017 and 2018. I'm sorry, throughout 2016 and 2017 to receive input on the individual amendments themselves. And the amendments were also brought forward as part of the council's process throughout 2017 and early 2018. So there were also numerous council meetings that were held to receive public input on the amendments. With regard to the environmental impact report, a scoping meeting was held in 2017 shortly after release of the notice of preparation. And the council also held a public hearing in December 2017 to receive comments on the draft EIR at that time.
Thank you.
Any other comments, questions? Okay, then the motion is to delay taking action on the staff recommendation for 60 days. Let's vote.
Weinberg, nay.
Tatayan, nay.
Fiorini, no.
Aranian, no.
Thompson, proudly, aye.
Motion fails 5-2. Okay, so now we will turn to public comment unless there are any other questions by council members. Okay. We want to make sure that everyone who wants to provide comments on the plan amendments and or the final EIR have an opportunity to speak. To my colleagues on the council, please withhold comments until we've heard from all of the members of the public. We will take public comments in the order we have received the completed blue request to comment cards. If you wish to comment but have not yet completed a blue request to comment card, please do so at this time. Again, after we hear from everyone who has filled out a request to comment card, we will hear from council members. Finally, when you come up to the microphone here on our right to speak, we ask that you do a couple of things so that the council and the audience may hear you. and so that your comments are entered into the record. First, speak clearly into the microphone, and second, please begin by stating your name and identifying the organization you represent, if any. So now let's begin hearing from the public, beginning with Jennifer Pierre.
Good morning, Chair Fiorini and Council. I'm Jennifer Pierre. I represent the State Water Contractors, which is an organization of 27 public water agencies that receive water from the Delta. We are very happy to see the final amendments in general. We think a lot of our concerns have been addressed. There's been a lot of context provided in the final that I think provides information necessary to understanding the amendments and the direction that the plan is headed. And so in general, we support that direction. There are a few remaining issues we have, and I want to raise them in hopes that you'll consider them today to potentially adjust the final amendment. But if not that, at least consider as we move forward in implementation and review in the future, and including the habitat amendment that's upcoming. The first one I want to mention has to do with reduced reliance. We've made comments on this numerous times in the past. And the issue has to do with measuring reliance on the Delta at the export facilities. And the water that is exported may not necessarily originate from the Delta. And so measuring the reliance on the Delta through an export point does not take into account things, for example, if storage is constructed north of the Delta and the movement of that water through the Delta. It doesn't take into account what we know are a volatile climate. In fact, just last week there was a number of articles, or that was earlier this week, about the swings that we can expect. And so ideally, and consistent with the CSO amendment, we would be capturing that, and measuring some sort of reduction around that doesn't actually allow us to measure a reliance change on the Delta. So we continue to take issue with how that portion of the performance measure is articulated. Second, I want to mention in the water quality performance measure of salinity, there is still reference to this fall X2. And first of all, I would argue that it's out of place. In fact, we have argued that. This is the only reasonable and prudent alternative action from the two biological opinions that is pulled into this performance measure and added on top of the existing water quality control plan. It's also probably the most highly contested scientific-based regulation in the Delta. And it's really unfortunate that the Delta plan continues to endorse something that was written as an adaptive management plan, that continues to be a source of major debate, that will be the subject of an independent science review coming up in a few months, and is highly likely to be adjusted. I would also note that just in 2017, our wettest year on record, the Delta was in excess conditions the entire year, yet Delta smelt plummeted. The Fish and Wildlife Service also reviewed what I would consider best available science, which is incorporated into this performance measure, and found that changes in the RPA itself wouldn't actually impact Delta smelt based on the modeling that was done. And in fact, the smelt all probably perished in the summer because of high temperature. So the idea that any sort of fall outflow is necessary is highly debatable and is being debated. And again, we find it unfortunate that it's being used as a performance measure for a salinity performance measure in this amendment. Lastly, just on the Delta Levy Investment Strategy amendment, we note that that staff is recommending these become requirements. We disagree. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, Bob Wright.
Good morning, council members. I'm Bob Wright, representing Friends of the River, and we also transmitted to you yesterday a comment letter on behalf of a total of 11 public interest organizations objecting to adoption of the plan amendments and objecting to certification of the final PER. Just really had a very few things to say because it's obvious from the vote on the 5-2 vote to deny the motion for the 60-day extension that you're going to proceed today and you're going to adopt and certify no matter what any of us have to say. But when the staff says, as was said during the staff presentation, that the recommendations do not promote a specific project such as the California Water Fix, that's even more divorced from reality than when those types of things were said to you by your staff and the consultants back last spring. Because on July 21st, 2017, the Department of Water Resources gave final approval to the Water Fix Delta Water Tunnels. They issued their findings, adopted their notice of determination under CEQA, and they even filed that same day a validation action seeking to obtain court validation for the issuance of $8 billion worth of bonds to pay to construct the project. So in other words, when in your plan amendments you call for new conveyance, including underground, you are, and everybody knows that you are promoting the California Water Fix Delta Water Tunnels, because it is, that is absolutely the only thing out there. It's the project with the final approval from the State Department of Water Resources. So the situation in that regard has even worsened from what it was when we were talking to you last spring. Just a couple of other things to say. There's never been an explanation about how you are helping the Delta by calling for taking even more water out upstream from the Delta. Right now, since the water is exported from the South Delta, and we all know, you all know, that the Delta is impaired, the water quality standards are in a shambles and all of that, but when the water flows through the Delta before it's taken out, that does help Delta water quality, water supply, freshwater flows, agriculture, fish, public health, and all of that before it's removed. When you remove it before it does that, you are worsening the water situation in the Delta. You have never, all of you at least, have never recognize that. I think a couple of you do, but nobody else does. We all know that. We would hope for a miracle that somehow you would not adopt the plan amendments, not certify the final EIR today, and we'll see what happens. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Just a reminder for those who have been here and for those who have not, the lighting system on the podium is to assist the speaker in gauging the 3 minutes. The amber light comes on at about 30 seconds to go. Next, motion Meserve.
Good morning, OSHA Meserve for local agencies of the North Delta. Thank you for explaining the lighting system. I was wondering what that was telling me. I'm here today to state our ongoing local community and other water user Delta in the Delta concerns about the substance of the Delta Plan amendments as well as the environmental review process. Procedurally, also, I agree there isn't enough time to consider the responses to comments and the other information. I also disagree with the scheduling of this the amendments at 9 a.m. and then followed by some really long closed session where the public has to wait around and then come back for the other items. I think is really anti-public. And I would say with respect to the all the different outreach that's been listed, I know you guys do try to do a good job with that, but I don't think the public understands what you're doing or why. And With respect to the risk reduction measures, I would urge that you adopt that as a recommendation, not a policy. Over the years, we've had grave concerns about the interference of the Delta Council with other agencies that are already have the authority and the know-how to implement flood control, and that includes DWR's program as well as the Central Valley Flood Control Board and local reclamation and water districts. And so there's been a big problem with the technical ability of the DSC to actually help reduce risk, and so at least this should be a recommendation, and that would help in that if we need to respond to things that happen, we would not need to go in and reprioritize. We've never agreed that they should be a set priority as proposed in D-List, but making a recommendation would help somewhat with that. With respect to the conveyance amendments, we agree with Mr. Wright that it does choose to promote the new conveyance projects. Taking more water out of the estuary is not the answer and shouldn't be recommended by this body if it truly is a stewardship council. And it just relocates problems to the Northern Delta. And I think it's really unfortunate that there hasn't been consideration of what could be done in the upper watersheds, with which the council could do work to promote things in upper watersheds that would help improve reliability, and hasn't really done anything on that. We do appreciate that there has been consideration of some local community concerns in these conveyance amendments, but they're just recommendations, and we don't believe they'll make any difference when it comes to a consistency determination. And there's no explanation of how the how the conveyance promoted by this council would actually promote the co-equal goal of restoration or protect the Delta as a place. And so for that reason, we don't think those amendments are well considered. I disagree with the statements of the state water contractors that reduced reliance should not be measured at the Delta. The Delta receives two-thirds of the state's water flows, and whether they're stored upstream or not, that's Delta watershed water, and it would be appropriate to measure there. And also, I disagree that X2 is not important. That protects water quality in the fall, in particular, for local water users, and we know harmful algal blooms and other water weeds are a growing concern. So I would not agree that those should be changed. Thank you.
Thank you, OSHA. Next up, Alf Brandt.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity. My name is Alf Brandt. I am counsel for the speaker, but I am not here speaking for the speaker. I am here more to give you the background of the Delta Levee investment strategy and how it developed. And the more relevant part was I was the Water Parks and Wildlife. I was the water consultant at Water Parks and Wildlife from 2005 to 2010. I'm here to urge you to adopt it as a regulation. Because we've spent more than a decade on this. Shortly after I was recruited from Department of the Interior as a Delta lawyer there, I came into the assembly and we paid $500 million. The legislature approved $500 million to pay off the Paterno lawsuit. And so that started a lot of discussion about levy. There had been reports. Then Katrina happened, and suddenly we were all focused on levies and what that meant. And so we spent the next several years talking about this. I had conversations with some of OSHA's predecessors about the spending the money for levies on the Delta program, and they thought they should just run the program and decide how state money's getting spent. So in 2006, we conditioned spending on a South Delta levy program on the Secretary of Resources adopting priorities. Well, that led to a war between DWR and Department of Fish and Game about what those priorities should be. It was not until the next March that the Secretary issued a report saying, here's some priorities, just kind of saying, here's some priorities you might think about. Didn't really do that. So then there was continued discussion about priorities, and it was one I was continuing to push. DWR lower-level staff, non-lawyers, said, oh, well, because of Paterno, if we set priorities, the people who are on the lower end will have to pay for them because they'll say that's a taking, as the Paterno case was. That was wrong, but we kept pushing. So finally, the key part that I want to explain is why we used the word recommend in 2009. And that was, I started with that language. I said, you will set priorities. That was a change in the final weeks by the Senate senior staff said no, recommend. And we had a discussion about that. And the reason I agreed to accept recommend was because he said, we cannot give up the authority of the legislature to always, they're the ones who set priorities. We're the ones who have the authority to set priorities. We can't give that away. And I said, but any statute we set is going to trump whatever an agency does. But ultimately, and I see you quoted my language in my assembly analysis on the final day, I agreed to recommend because if we do something, if we adopt priorities, which is very unlikely, we've never done it, if we do it, then that takes care of you. But you're recommending, it's stronger than recommending, it's important that it be a regulation so that all the other agencies. We saw what happened last year. I was one who pushed to get language in the budget that tied spending of Delta levy funding to your Delta interim, where it stood last year, a Delta levy investment strategy. It's critical. Somebody needs to set priorities for our spending. We committed in 2006 a large amount of money in a water bond in 1E. We committed more in later water bonds. Somebody needs to set priorities. The legislature is not the best place to do that, has not done it. I'll just say it has not done it. And so go and set regulation, because I think that's going to be necessary to do the multiple. I mean, the fact that the legislature hasn't set it reflects the challenge of a lot of stakeholders with a lot of priorities, and everybody wants their money, and they need to be the first priority. So it's really, that's why we gave it to you, the responsibility to recommend priorities. And so I urge you to take that action today.
Oh, thank you. Next up, Gilbert Cozio.
Thank you, President Fiorini and members of the council. My name is Gilbert Cozio. I'm with MBK Engineers. We're the engineering consultants for about 40% of the Delta levies. Most of our districts are in the North and Central Delta. We have two in the South Delta. I'm here to comment on a couple of things. One, the discussion regarding public involvement. I was one of those involved in the public, speaking to you here, and also approached by Randy and the consultant to gather data from us so that they could put the best report together. One of my concerns was then and now is that your report relies on old data. Now, I understand the fact that you couldn't develop new data because of the time frame and the cost, but I feel firmly that the report you have now is going to have to change as new data develops. And I'll give you an example. Just in the last year, we found out that the opening at the planned North Delta plan project on McCormick-Williamson was too wide. The water coming in and out of McCormick-Williamson tract was going to impact the water quality in the South Delta. And that's the kind of stuff that's not in any published reports. And our concern was, and I know Contra Costa Water District raises the same thing, is that your report didn't look at hydrodynamics, and there are a lot of lacking information in how levee breaches will affect hydrodynamics, and so that's one of the things you're going to run into. Also, I've been involved in a lot of the changes in the law that affected the levee program, starting in '88 with the SB 34 program, then SB 1065, and 1991, and then AB 360 in 1996. And each one of those went through a lot of growing pains. And unless you're able to adaptively manage and change a little bit, it makes it difficult. Each one took about 2 to 3 years to really get into the full flow of implementation. So I guess if you are going to vote for approval, I would suggest it's a recommendation just to add that flexibility. As Mr. Stambro suggested, the regulation is going to make it much harder. And the last thing I want to say, I'm really concerned that as things are changing, on the flood, state plan of flood control, I'm a little concerned that your plan is going to take you sideways with two of your members that are signatories to your MOU, the Flood Protection Board and DWR. We've got a lot of issues right now on repair of erosion sites that happened in 2017. The Corps is not coming to fix them. DWR is trying to. We're going to get about 10% of that work done. 90% won't get done. A lot of money needs to be spent there. Some of those islands in the Delta are low priority, the ones that protect Clarksburg and Cortland. And so the chance of them getting money and able to be repaired is going to be a problem. which is going to put us sideways with the Corps, which means the local sponsor, the state, is going to have to do something about that. And we feel that the regulation vote would make it so inflexible, it's going to be difficult to get some of those higher priority items that may come up through your member agencies considered. Thank you.
Gil, thank you for that. Rebecca Aykroyd.
Good morning. Rebecca Aykroyd for the San Luis and Delta Mendota Water Authority. I'd like to first join in the comments of Jennifer Pierre for state water contractors, specifically for the reasons outlined by Jennifer and in the written comments of the Water Authority, state water contractors, and Westlands. We would repeat our request to the Council that you revise performance measures 3.9, submeasure 4.2, and 6.2 prior to adopting the amendments. These proposed amendments on reduced reliance in delta flows and salinity, including FALX2, conflict with the co-equal goals of the Delta Reform Act or lack the support of best available science. In addition, we would request that with respect to DLIS, you adopt option one as including the DLIS recommendations rather than regulation. And for those reasons, we would request that you postpone adopting the amendments and certifying the PEIR today. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other members of the public that wish to comment this morning? Okay, well, thank you all that that have prepared and provided comments. I think now it would be good, Jessica, to ask you or Jeff to remind the council what the staff recommendation is before we begin our deliberations.
Sure, maybe we can have the last slide from the PowerPoint presentation.
Previous slide to this one.
Sorry, second to last.
Thank you. That one. All right, thank you. And just as a reminder, the staff's recommended action is to adopt the proposed resolution that's attached to the staff report, which would certify the final EIR, adopt the findings and statement of overriding considerations, adopt and incorporate the new proposed mitigation measure 5.2-1 into the Delta Plan, adopt the mitigation monitoring and reporting program, adopt amendments to Chapter 7 for DLIS, including policy RRP1 as a regulation, adopt amendments to Chapter 3 for CSO, adopt amendments to Appendix E for the PMs, direct council staff to initiate rulemaking, including modification of policy GP1B2, and direct the executive officer to correct errata to complete identified non-substantive changes, including any changes that may be identified today, and to make changes required by the Office of Administrative Law to complete rulemaking.
Okay, you've heard the recommendation. What's the pleasure of the council? Mike?
So I just want to address something that Mr. Wright stated in his comments. First, I want to thank you for your very excellent letter that you submitted, signed by a number of great organizations, Sierra Club, Planning Conservation League. Read your letter thoroughly. I think you make some very, very good points. I do want to take issue, though, respectfully, with one of the things you said in your presentation on the nature of, sort of the outcome being predetermined. And for me, that was it was moderately to deeply offensive. This is a very deliberative body. I speak for myself. I think I speak for everybody else on the board, is that we work very hard to read the materials we're given, including your letter, which I thought was thorough and excellent, and to listen to public comments before we make a decision. And when you say things like that, it's a little bit troubling for someone like me who prides myself in making decisions based on the materials before us. And I come into every meeting with the express purpose of listening to the public. Hopefully, I'm not limited by time. An old politician can be very wordy. But I mean, you know, I think all of us come into every meeting with an intention of listening to the public, reading all the materials before us, and making the best possible decision. So I just want to, hopefully that comes as a reassurance to you, but I couldn't let that comment go unaddressed. But thank you for being here.
Others? Susan?
I'd like to thank everyone who came and spoke for your various interests. And I just want to address one of Gilcosio's concerns about the proposed D-list regulation. The department maintains its ability to decide what projects it funds, and although the regulation does set priorities, the department can still fund one of those low priority projects and report to the council its rationale for funding that project. So the DWR's hands are not as tied as you're interpreting. So I hope that that sets your mind at ease a bit.
Judge, and then Skip.
I just want to comment on what Mike Gatto said. I come from a background where no one knows why the judge made a decision. It's the least transparent aspect of our society, albeit maybe the best we can do. The judicial branch operates as it does oftentimes in the secrecy of a judge's chambers. He issues a decision. No one's quite certain why that person made that decision. Hopefully the decision itself provides adequate basis, and oftentimes it always does. But my point here is that this has been a pretty transparent experience for me. This is quite the opposite of a judicial proceeding. This is where all the cards are on the table, where you hear exactly what people think, and it's important. This is a public body, and we should. Our decisions are based upon public input, not on private input. And I just want to underscore the fact that I think the process has been transparent. We have heard what people have said, we've listened, and hopefully a decision we make will be based not only upon what we heard, but what we read and understand as a result of the staff's recommendations or the expert opinions of scientists and such. My point is, I believe this has been transparent, and without being transparent, we shouldn't be here doing these things or making these decisions. But my view is, it has been a very transparent proceeding, and I want to underscore that. That's my experience in the last, I guess, 5 or 6 years, that we have listened and heard what you have spoken about, and your comments have been listened to very carefully.
Skip?
I guess I'd like to underscore some of what the judge and Mike Otto said. Even though I've been at the short end of most of the votes on this council, I think my colleagues have tried to listen to the public, take all that information in, and make a informed vote that recognizes the public's disagreement. I'd like to suggest that the D-list be a recommendation and not a regulation. And why do I say that? I mean, in the staff report under purpose and scope on page 3, it talks about project revises D-list CSO and PM components. Why? Because of changed circumstances and conditions in the Delta. If you have a recommendation, I would assume that allows you to be more flexible and allows you to do things based on changed circumstances in the Delta. One of the issues under the option 1, which is a recommendation, the challenges, as staff put it, relies on the willing participation of signatories to the MOU. You know, My readings and what I've heard, DWR and the Flood Board are willing partners in this effort, but they have concerns about the recommendation as opposed or regulation as opposed to recommendation. And I would think that partnerships is how we're going to get this delta preserved, and we're going to achieve the goals of less reliance on this delta. So I would hope that my colleagues would look seriously at the recommendation as opposed to the regulation, because we need flexibility. We need to be able to change, as I think all of you may know, Jerry Merrill. When I became a board member 5 years ago, Jerry met with me, and he goes, you know, we need to have adaptive management. And I said, well, what's that? He shared with me that things change in the Delta, and we need to be able to change with them. And so it seems quite logical that the regulation would tie our hands in some regards. And so the recommendation is a recommendation to have a recommendation instead of regulation would be the appropriate position for this council to take. Thank you.
Skip, I think the appropriate way to take that up will be after the council has completed asking questions of staff. I would recommend that we take up the staff recommendation as a motion, and if it's seconded, then we could take your thoughts about a recommendation as an amendment to the motion. Would that be a suitable way to address it?
You know, Randy, you and I chatted earlier before the meeting, and I want to be able to vote appropriately on each one of these items. And so if we're going to be able to separate each one of them out, that would be my ask of the council. Otherwise, I'm put in a position where I'm going to vote no on all four, and I don't think that's fair to those that I represent, and it's not fair to how I see my role in this council. So I hope my colleagues would indulge me to allow at least discussion on each one of them and a separate vote if it comes to that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And I think to accomplish that, the best thing to do is to start with the staff recommendation and go from there, if that's suitable for you. Okay, before I accept a motion, we have more questions and comments.
Well, just, you know, in the vein that we have listened to the public from the beginning of this process to today, and the reason I asked the outside counsel to talk about the process is that, from my experience, it's very typical that at this point an EIR is certified and without delay, because we had this extensive process. So that was the reason I just wanted to reiterate that we're not doing anything unusual. In fact, we're due, you know, this is the end of a very long process that's been in play for 3 years. And I want to thank OSHA for being the only one to recognize that we did hear the concerns of the community. We also heard that no is where they are. And you know, but, you know, our job is to balance statewide needs and priorities and achieve the co-equal goals. And I remember during one of the, and I'm the most non-politician on this council, but I do remember at a public meeting talking about, gee, we're trying to strike a balance, and one of the audience members said, no, we're not, we don't want balance. And I was like, gee, what do you do with that? But that's our job. And I think the reason that, you know, we said you need a second diversion and we didn't say where is because the preponderance of science says that contributes to the co-equal goals. And there is a way to achieve balance. And Mr. Wright, the reason we said that it should be underground is that's the least intrusive to the community, as opposed to, you know, cut and cover and open trench and all that kind of thing for the long period of construction. And I think we did a lot of listening to the community, and there's a lot of recommendations in there that says, well, if you build these types of facilities, then you need to work with the community. You need to work with the elected officials. You need to deal with transportation problems. We heard the business concerns about boat cruises, you know, conflicting with barges, and how do you take care of that? And you have to have a detailed plan of construction sequencing. All those things are there, but, you know, we had at the top of mind, how do you protect the Delta as a place during this kind of disruptive activity? And we all know that. So I think, you know, want to just point to that because it didn't really come out in the staff presentation, but I think for us as a council, you know, that was a key priority. Didn't feel we could say no because the science didn't justify saying no, and achieving the co-equal goals didn't justify saying no, but let's do this the best way we can. There was, you know, I just want to talk just a little bit about the DLIS, and I really appreciate the comments, and Mr. Cosio has convinced me that more than ever, money is the problem. And I was pretty shocked at the amount of revenue generated from the property owners versus the need and the fact that we're living one bond issue to the next. And so with limited resources, you have to have priorities, and those priorities need to be followed, and maybe that results in more funding. But Mr. Cosio convinced me the amount of revenue that you can get from those property owners is severely limited. And that's probably not going to change. So we've got, you know, front and center. This is a money issue, and you have to start with prioritizing for funding. So, you know, and I'd like to thank everybody who's come. And this is, you know, we had many, many hours of public testimony, and we heard you, and the staff did a really tremendous job in trying to pull all this together and give us the best product that they could. So thank you.
Ken, Maria?
Yes. I'd like to thank, first of all, the chair and the staff for the work that they've done in the past 2 weeks in bringing me along and briefing me on the process that has gone on, making me kind of like understand and follow and be able to talk about it, hopefully intelligently, and vote today. But from all the readings and all the briefings that I've received, I come to the point that this body is created in stewardship of the Delta, and it's important. And there's a lot of dollars spent on the science side of it. So for us, and at the same time, knowing that we're working in a changing environment in the Delta and using the dollars to do the scientific research, if we do not have the ability to have regulations versus recommendations, in a way I'm thinking that it all goes to waste, because there's something about timeliness of implementing those findings that come out of science in terms of where we invest, and how we protect the Delta. And somehow coming up with list of recommendations I don't think justifies all the efforts that is behind the work that this body does. So with that, you know, I'm just wanting to reiterate that I'm more on the side of seeing this as a regulation than a recommendation. Thank you.
Mike. Okay, so just some questions, because I want to make sure that we're all on the same page. So I see two options in the staff report, agenda item 3. Option 1 is to adopt the D-list prioritization as a recommendation. Option 2 is to incorporate the D-list prioritization as a regulation. I believe Mr. Brandt spoke and recommended option 2. Did I hear Council Member Thompson speak in favor of option 1 or option 2? Option 1. Okay. I was confused. I thought you guys were agreeing on something. All righty. Well, I'm glad I asked, and I'm glad we clarified that. And then to be clear, when our chairman said we were going to vote, or his suggestion was that we're going to vote on the staff recommendation, the staff has not made a recommendation vis-a-vis the options.
Yes, they have.
They have.
My recommendation is that the motion begin with considering the staff recommendation, which includes D-list as a regulation.
So option 2.
Yes.
Got it.
Yeah,
okay.
Well, option 2, but it's in the resolution, it's listed as a, a regulation.
Okay.
Which is option 2.
Thank you very much, everybody, for the clarification.
Okay. Other questions of staff? You ready for a motion?
And I'm sorry, one more question. This, the
staff recommendation that we're about to vote on, this is also to certify the PEIR, or this is just on adopting option two for that part of the EIR?
It is to adopt the three amendments and certify the final EIR.
Okay.
And the staff recommendation is to treat it as a package. And Skip has suggested that he would like to extract portions of it for further deliberation. So the starting point will be a motion to kick off the deliberation.
I should be clear, too, then. I lean in favor of extracting certain points as well to vote on it piecemeal, but obviously I will defer to the will of the committee or of the council.
Mm-hmm. Would somebody care to offer a motion?
So I just want to be clear that the motion concerns adopting the resolution as written. So moved.
Okay.
Second.
We have a motion and a second to adopt the resolution as presented in our binder and as explained by Jeff Henderson.
The whole thing.
The whole package.
Okay. Well, I'd like to make some comments, Mr. Chair, if
sure.
I may. I'd like to start with the D list, and maybe I should be a little more clear why I think it should not be a regulation, should be a recommendation. You know, there are multiple agencies that have been involved in flood work in the Delta. I've mentioned DWR, the flood board, and I think they've worked in concert with the DSC. So to simply dismiss their willingness to work together, I don't think is appropriate. The agencies dealing with the labor program need flexibility. If they're, changing circumstances, I made reference to it already, they may not be able to be considered by the council. So a Delta plan recommendation provides that flexibility. A policy change would require another amendment to the Delta plan, and that is a big deal, according to my staff and from what I've read. Other problems include, and Gil Cozio and some of the folks that work in the Delta on the levees, the problems include the ability to pay and the additional cost per mile, deductible. Finally, the map and the narrative of the islands is too specific, again, going back to some flexibility. Now I'd like to put on my Delta Protection Commission chair hat and talk about some things that we've done at the commission that is not being considered. You know, starting back in 2012 with our economic sustainability plan, we've advocated, we the Delta Protection Commission, for a Delta-wide improvement levy standard, the PL 84-99, the DWR Bulletin 192-82, a standard that can be achieved by all the levies in the district. Because, you know, we often think about just levies, but there are people and there are legacy communities that are involved here. So that the biggest problem is the levy investment strategy is that it rejects the imperative for a Delta-wide improvement of levies to the Bulletin 192-82 standard, and thus is insufficiently attentive to protecting and enhancing the unique Delta values. And that often gets lost in our discussion. We become so focused on levies and prioritizing the levies, we forget about the Delta and what it is, what it means to the state. You know, I've often advocated, even at my own peril with my colleagues, is that we need, as a state, to come up with a statewide solution. You know, and the levees are part of that conveyance to move water through the Delta. So I would implore you to think more on flexibility, the ability of different agencies to work together, and the public that had, you know, it's surprising how much the public knows about the Delta. They live there, they work there, and so we should listen to them in great detail. I mean, even water contractors, I'm agreeing with the water contract. That's something. So, again, I would ask that you consider a recommendation instead of the regulations for the reasons I've stated. Thank you.
And let me just argue the other side, which is you know, I think Mr. Brandt made some very salient points in his presentation, which is, you know, the legislature has not stepped in and made passed anything with the effect of law on this topic. And I think when that situation is what we find ourselves in, it's appropriate for an agency like this with particular knowledge in the executive branch to step in and pass these D-list factors as a actual regulation. So I support that, and I believe it is the right thing to do. Thank you.
Other comments on the motion, Ken?
Maybe just a question, Mr. Chair, of you or staff, just the, you know, the issue that Skip brings up about flexibility and working together among agencies. I mean, how do we see the regulation inhibiting that, or do we see that we're still going to be able to maintain some flexibility and you know, react to changing conditions, that kind of thing?
Well, I was going to comment in favor of the motion, and so I'll take your question as an opportunity to address the issues that have been raised and give you my personal view. Having been involved with the Delta Levy investment strategy from day one, I have had the opportunity to see the ebbs and flows of the relationship that exists between the Stewardship Council, the Flood Board, and DWR. And it has not been a smooth path. We were handed a job to do, and as I think Alf painted a good picture of the difficulty that arises when somebody parachutes into someone else's kitchen to help. We were given a job to prioritize levy state investment in Delta levies for a reason. And we took that very seriously. We have a regulation in place today that was adopted in May of 2013. It wasn't a recommendation, it was a regulation, because we felt that to achieve the and fulfill the assignment that the legislature gave us in statute, it was worthy of a regulation. We promised at the adoption of the May 2013 Delta Plan that we would further refine the details and provide a list. We employed the RAND Corporation, who successfully helped Louisiana Coast deal with post-Katrina issues to help direct investments in the levee system in that area. So this wasn't something that was done without a great deal of expertise. As Gil indicated, I have engaged frequently with the experts in the Delta, and I have personally, my involvement has been to achieve two goals. Number one, fulfill the job the legislature gave us, and that is to develop a prioritization list. Number two, to do that in a manner that provides flexibility to the lead agency, the Department of Water Resources, and their counterpart, the Flood Board, to make judgments based on changing conditions, because we all know that the constant in the Delta is change. This regulation achieves both of those goals. There is a variance provision in the regulation that allows DWR to alter the investment to a lower priority, anticipating that there may be changing conditions. And they simply have to report to the council at least annually as to where the investments were made and the reasons why they were made. And if they were not in keeping with the highest priorities and on down, the reasons why. So the report that we received at our March 22nd meeting indicated that the three agency staff that have been working on an implementation plan for the MOU had been making progress. And we were all pleased with that. And that progress needs to continue, because there is a partnership that has been created in statute between the Stewardship Council, the Central Valley Flood Protection Board, and DWR to protect lives and people and property to the fullest extent we can with the limited state dollars. An implementation plan has not been completed for that memorandum of understanding. And so whether this goes as a recommendation or regulation, the need for an implementation plan continues. And our staff stands prepared to continue meeting weekly with representatives from the other two agencies to fulfill that assignment that did not meet their deadline by the end of last year. So for those reasons, I want to speak in favor of the motion before us, including DLIS as a regulation.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
You know, I can count the votes, and I'm not going to belabor this point, but I am going to make my concerns voiced and share why I'll be voting against the resolution. You know, I've already talked about the lack of what I think is enough time for those of us and the public to weigh in and study this enormous document. You know, and I don't think there's been enough focus on priorities of the Delta plan. And what I mean by that is there's been too much focus on conveyance and at the expense or peril of the local communities, farms, and the region itself. There's no place to store water during high flows, you know, and that's the obvious time that we need to store the water for future needs. The State Water Project will require system-wide improvements sooner than later. Not enough focus on other priorities to develop new and more reliable water sources. Not enough focus on reduced reliance on the Delta. And consideration of all the plan chapters together. I mean, we've taken one chapter here, one chapter there, and it doesn't flow very well. And I believe it was Mr. Wright that talked about the environmental document ought to be able to be picked up by the average public concerned citizen and have some ability to read it flowing. And when you have to look at one appendix to another, it just doesn't work well. And finally, we don't even know how much water we have. You know, we're assuming there's X amount of water, but we really don't. And I think these are the things that we need to address before we start moving forward with a plan that I think is materially flawed. And I've already shared my concerns about the D-list. So anyway, I will be voting no on this resolution. But I appreciate all my colleagues and their positions as well.
Any other comments on the motion? Question's been called for. We'll vote. Ken?
Weinberg, aye.
Dammer, aye.
Gatto, no.
Tatayan, aye.
Fiorini, aye.
Marani, aye.
Thompson, no.
Motion passes 5-2. Thank you very much. Again, as I mentioned earlier, this is the culmination of years of effort, countless hours, and we thank you for the public participation. Thank you for the staff and consultant team. That now completes file item number 3. The next item, file item number 4, is a recess to closed executive session. For those of you that are following on the webcast, I expect that we will be in closed session for at least 1 hour. We are now recessed to closed executive session.
I know. Have to stay 2 more minutes.
So, as Bob is getting all the knobs and dials turned. The AV crew is out to lunch, and they're okay. So we are operational. Calling the meeting back to order. I have nothing to report coming out of closed session. The next item is file item number 6, adoption of the March 22nd meeting summary.
I would recuse myself.
Okay. Maria recuses herself. Can I get a...
There was one correction that I saw. In the summary of John Duran's article, or his lessons on drought, he's referred to as Dr. Brandt by mistake. So just correct.
Oh, yeah.
It sometimes says Dr. Durant and sometimes says Dr. Brandt.
Okay, so we can make that, we can correct that. Any other corrections?
I have a question on page 6 of agenda item 6. It says, Chair Fiorini acknowledged there is a solution to this problem and invited Mr. Cosio to present at the flood board and continue to help shape the solution for this issue. Is that accurate? You invited Gil to present to the flood board?
No, I missed that. What number is it on?
Agenda item 6, page 6.
Page 4, 5, 6.
At the bottom here.
We're happy to review the video from the last meeting, too, if there's a question about that.
Yeah, that doesn't... I don't have a memory of that. I think the issue was the ability to pay, and I think if you, if the mini, the meeting... summary concluded with there is a solution to this problem and ended it with that. I think that would accurately reflect the conversation. So that's thank you for catching that. So the last item on the last paragraph on page 6 should read, Chair Fiorini acknowledged that there is a solution to this problem. Okay. Any other corrections? All right. With those two corrections, I'd be happy to entertain a motion to accept. Okay. We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Let's vote.
Weinberg, aye.
Zambo, aye.
I'm allowed to vote aye. Aye.
Otto, aye.
Tatayan, aye.
Fiorini, aye.
Thompson, aye.
And Maranian, abstains. Okay, so we have motion passes. Thank you for that. next item, file item number 7, the chair's report. The last 2 weeks have been probably the busiest 2 weeks of my life. A week ago, Monday, we had the 9th Delta Plan Interagency Implementation Committee meeting, and I am pleased to report that it went very, very well. I'd like to call on Amanda Bull, the Delta Plan Interagency Implementation Committee Coordinator, to give you a brief rundown on the meeting.
Great. Thank you, Chair Fiorini, and good afternoon, members. So as Randy mentioned, the first DPIC meeting of 2018 was just this past Monday on the 16th. And for those of you that are newer to the council, excuse me, as well. We have two DPIC meetings a year, one generally in April and the second one in November. So we enjoyed a really robust and productive discussion with representatives from each of the 17 DPIC agencies, so we were happy to have full participation. And the meeting really focused around three key topic areas. Topic one focused on building momentum for best practices and recommendations from the California Water Action Plan and the Delta Plan to continue and to communicate to the new administration.
whomever that is. Topic two asks committee members to commit to thinking beyond current restoration requirements to achieve integrated and ecosystem-based restoration. And we had Dr. Jeffrey Mount from the Public Policy Institute of California there to kind of kick off the discussion based on an outline of the recent blog post that PPIC released, which were presented to all of you at the last council meeting. And then we had a very good discussion from with many of the members of the committee on that topic. And topic three explored science governance in the Delta and addressed the Delta Science Plan update as it considers how governance can better support decision making. We had a panel of governance experts, so to speak, Mark Lubell from UC Davis, a professor at UC Davis, Tracy Collier, who is a member of the Delta Independent Science Board, and then also Bruce DeGennaro, who is the facilitator for CSAMP, or the Collaborative Science Adaptive Management Program. And so they were there to address a couple of questions that we had posed to them beforehand, and then following kind of that, we had a nice good back and forth discussion amongst the committee members and the panelists as well on governance, especially as it relates, again, to the science plan update. So the primary outcomes from the meeting were threefold. First, council staff will be drafting a Delta Issues briefing paper over the next few months to be endorsed at the November committee meeting, and we will be providing that to the new administration as kind of a ideas on kind of the best things that these agencies feel we should continue to do in the Delta. The Delta Science Program staff will continue to work on updating the Delta Science Plan in cooperation with the Delta Agency Science Work Group, which is a subcommittee of DPIC. And the updated science plan will be presented to the committee at the November DPIC meeting. And the committee is also going to be asked to endorse and to sign the preamble to the Delta Science Plan update. And then finally, again, focusing on governance, the committee members agreed to continue engaging in discussions regarding governance and Delta Science funding. So we'll really be using the next 6 months to really kind of dive into that topic much more deeply. So thank you.
Amanda, good review. And as you can see, the outcomes were significant at this meeting. Comments?
Quick comment. My role as a local government guy is always to remind folks that local government and stakeholders are out there. And I was pleased that a number of the agencies acknowledged my comments. And if I can just keep beating that drum to remind folks we're here, we're willing to help, and can be helpful in the processes. Lots going on in the Delta that impact agriculture, the small communities, people that live there. And so we'd like to share our concerns and our be helpful in the process. But I was just wanting to acknowledge the acknowledgement of some of the agencies. Thank you.
Ken?
Thank you, Chair. I attended the DPIC meeting for the first time. And, it was very interesting. I was there as an observer. And Skip, your comments did resonate because you can't disagree with them. And you know, it was...
Well, why am I on the short end of a vote all the time here?
Doesn't mean they don't resonate.
It was a joke, Randy. I'm sorry.
But, it was interesting that you had all of these federal and state agencies there. You really had the entire combined bureaucracy, and I thought that Randy expertly kept moving them to, how do you fit into the overall Delta plan? How are we, moving all of this forward? And many of them responded, and I think if they didn't respond, Randy, it was pretty clear that they were, focused, I'll use the kind term, on their mission-specific goals. And so that was a really interesting forum, and the exchange with Jeff Mount, really, as we get into the ecosystem restoration amendment, in moving from just planning to implementation, it just is a really valuable venue, and I was really impressed with how it went and how you managed that meeting.
Thank you. Anyone else? Well, I just want to acknowledge Amanda's hard work. There's a lot of effort that goes into that four-hour meeting, beginning with individual meetings with each of the DPIC member agencies 3 months in advance. To help shape the agenda to make it as meaningful as possible. And I think we've received a lot of good input and have an opportunity for continued dialogue in support of the science plan update and the ecosystem chapter updates. So I was very pleased. And so, Amanda, thank you. Good report. Next up, Seth Yund, as he comes to the microphone, I will remind you, is our executive fellow. We try and provide executive fellows an opportunity to identify an issue related to the work of the Stewardship Council that they have an interest in and would like to contribute in some way that results in a paper or a product that they can call their own and point to as a part of their career path. So it's a little bit like, at least in San Luis Obispo, it's a little bit like a Cal Poly senior project. And so I've asked Seth to come and describe briefly the topic that he has chosen and to give you some expectations about what's to come in the next few months. Seth, welcome.
Thank you, Chairman Fiorini, and thank you, Council, for giving me the opportunity to share with you this thesis project, if you will, that I'll be working on for the remainder of my fellowship. As you know, 160 years of reclamation and intensive farming practices in the Delta have led to a decline in wildlife habitat, along with associated peat subsidence of agricultural land. The state and council have expressed an interest in addressing these issues on working lands. However, effective solutions must consider a wide array of state and local environmental, agricultural, and economic needs. To acknowledge and address these needs, I will be exploring a new model for fulfilling the Delta Plan's recommendation DPR-10, encouraging wildlife-friendly agriculture in the Delta, and recommendation DPR-7 on subsidence reduction and reversal. Using land subsidence reversal and mitigation as a case study, my project will explore the governance structure, policy requirements, and incentives needed to encourage working landowners to adopt wildlife-friendly agricultural practices. With my remaining 4 months at the Council, I will be finalizing a white paper that explores how to coordinate and streamline existing public and private funding programs to make wildlife-friendly agriculture incorporation more accessible and economically viable for landowners in the Delta. At the July meeting, I will be presenting this white paper, as well as leading a discussion panel on this topic. Thank you for your time and attention. I look forward to presenting this white paper to you in July, and I look forward to any questions you may have at this time.
Hey, nice job. Any questions of Seth? Yes, Susan.
Would you be willing to share with us some of what you've found so far?
Yeah, sure. I was surprised by the number of working lands projects that exist across the state, and what I've learned is that there are a lot of initiatives that have either not been solely focused on the complex Delta region, or because of the complexity, have met with challenges that have not led to their continuation. As far as what I've found so far, there are a lot of the existing programs leave me optimistic that consolidation can really be a great path forward, and I'm looking forward to exploring that consolidation of existing programs to not necessarily ask for additional funding from the state, explore possibilities for what I'm calling credit stacking or incentive stacking to really take land as a case by case and really see how individuals' needs can be met.
Ken?
Yeah, Seth, are you going to go out and talk to farmers?
I would like to, yes. I'm not going to go into too many details because I don't want to make any promises on exactly how things will turn out, but I do have plans to reach out to specific islands in the Delta, and I will be using certain islands in the Delta as a case studies in my white paper.
Okay. No, good.
Okay. Seth, great.
Thank you.
Great job. We'll look forward to hearing more. Okay, I have one more item, and that is to call on Vice Chair Tatayan for a Delta Ecosystem Chapter Subcommittee update.
Thank you, Chair. I am pleased to say that after Ken and I and Chair Fiorina met with the team working on the ecosystem amendment that I am convinced it's going to be quite a rigorous chapter amendment. The staff is doing an incredible amount of work in a very short time in as systematic and scientifically rigorous manner as they can. They are considering on every aspect of the amendment how to reach out to the locals. So, Skip, I think you've impressed the staff with the importance of working with folks and reaching out to those who will be affected by the ecosystem amendment. And the progress made thus far in this short amount of time is really encouraging. So thank you to the staff.
Any questions of Susan? If not, then that completes file item number 7. On to file item number 8, the executive officer's report, Jessica Law.
Thank you. So, Susan, that's actually a really good segue to my first item, which is an update on the ecosystem amendment. There are 3 scientific synthesis papers that are now available. They're up on our website. We are asking for comments on these papers, and specifically comments that are directly related to how the findings of the synthesis papers should be used in developing the chapter amendment. These are working documents, and the council actually has a fairly long history of using white papers or synthesis papers to help form policy development. So we have received one set of comments so far from Restore the Delta, and we are expecting additional comments from the Delta Independent Science Board. We're reviewing those papers with the interagency committee, and we're looking forward to more discussion. We'll have a memo update in May on the ecosystem amendment, and then a full presentation in June. So on to the next item, Delta Plan Implementation and Coordination Letters. Dr. Calloway and I submitted a coordination letter on March 28th on a joint planning and science program review of the Department of Water Resources progress report on implementing the Open and Transparent Water Data Act. They've developed an initial draft strategic plan and preliminary protocols. So we are really pleased to see that the progress that's been made to date on this and really appreciate being included in the ongoing coordination efforts on this. The work in implementation of AB 1755 really supports the work on the Delta Plan performance measures and helps. In particular, we really appreciate the integration of the principles that were put forward in our white paper, Enhancing the Vision for Managing California's Environmental Information. So we will receive, actually the council will receive a full report on AB 1755 implementation at the May council meeting. So you'll hear a lot more from the report authors then. On April 20th, council staff submitted a comment letter on the mitigated neg deck for the proposed Chemours Oakley site sediment and soil groundwater corrective measure study. Whew, that's a mouthful. Based on the project location and scope, council staff encouraged DTSC to identify the project as a covered action. Currently, the City of Oakley zoning designates the area as an SP3 pending, and the City General Plan designations and the project site location within the County of Contra Costa's urban limit line indicate that the project may be exempt from some otherwise pertinent Delta Plan policies. However, other Delta Plan policies, such as ERP2, appear to be relevant. So the council really appreciates this effort to remediate its contaminant site currently, and you know, certainly by remediating the site, contaminants that are existing there really are going to negatively impact the economic and ecological use of the site. So we're looking forward to hearing more about that project. A few quick personnel announcements. So one, I want to inform the council that Livia Dossman, the Deputy Executive Officer for Administration, retired earlier this month. Livia had a 37-year career in state service. So she first came to work for us in 2006. She was actually hired to help transformation of the California Bay Delta Authority into a program at the Natural Resources Agency. And then she did such a good job, it was actually supposed to be a temporary assignment. But she stayed on, and you know, of course, from 2006 to 2010, it turned into another major transition, which is the Delta Stewardship Council. So she's been through many transitions with us. Livia really helped establish the council. She kept us organized and moving forward, and we really, really miss her. So we wish her well in retirement, and hopefully she'll come to our holiday party. Two other announcements. We're really excited to announce that Maggie Christman, who is an environmental scientist in the science program, has been promoted to a program manager 2 position. She will lead a reorganized science communication, synthesis, and decision support unit and lead our staff in work to transform data into information and relevant science syntheses and move integrated forecasting and scenario planning models forward. Maggie's already made significant contributions to the council. She was the managing editor for the State of Bay Delta Science and also the lead editor on the Delta Challenges Report, and she's going to start her new position May 1st. One more, I don't know if she's still here. Amanda Wasserman is a new Sea Grant Fellow. Amanda received her master's in Applied Marine and Watershed Science from California State University in Monterey Bay. She graduated this past May. While there, she studied the use of underwater stereo, video, and geospatial technologies to examine landscape ecology of nearshore fish communities along the coast of California. It sounds like fun. Prior to the fellowship, Amanda worked as a researcher for Sea Change Analytics, and then she also just finished up an internship with the NASA DEVELOP national program at the NASA Ames Research Center in Mountain View. So she'll be working with us on science communications, and she will be giving you the By the Numbers report. She just started a week ago, so we're going to give her a pass this month, but you'll see her at the next few council meetings. So with that, I'd like to invite Ryan Stambra, the council's legislative advisor, to join us. So council members, at the last meeting, we discussed the council's policy concerning official positions and sponsorship of legislation. We've included that policy in your binders this month, and along with some further analysis of 2 bills on which the council can take action.
Thank you, Jessica. Good morning again, or good afternoon, shall I say, Mr. Chairman and council members. Before turning to those 2 bills, I'd like to start my report this month by providing a follow-up on the council's budget change proposal that seeks additional science and personnel resources. On April 4th and 5th, council staff testified before the budget subcommittees in both houses, where the proposal was ultimately approved for inclusion into the final budget package that will be voted on in June. Moving on to AB 1876 by Assemblymember Jim Frazier. As the council may recall, this was a bill that proposed to dissolve the council and merge its duties and functions with that of the Delta Protection Commission. The measure received its first policy committee hearing earlier this week, and by a vote of 0-6, with 8 members registering as not voting, the bill failed to pass out of its first policy committee. As a result, AB 1876 is now dead for this year. And then finally, as Jessica mentioned at the March meeting, the council requested staff to further analyze 2 bills for consideration at the April meeting. The first is AB 2053 by Assemblymember Bill Quirk from Alameda, which would establish a harmful algal bloom task force made up of a variety of public agencies. From a background perspective, the current science is telling us that nutrients, particularly nitrogen and phosphorus, continue to pose significant water quality challenges in the Delta, like these blooms, as well as invasive aquatic plants and primary production impacts. The Delta Plan acknowledges this nutrient-related challenge through a series of recommendations related to the State Board, largely aimed at improving monitoring and research. Consistent with this thinking, the science program is currently funding research in advance of the Sacramento Regional Sanitation Plant upgrade. This bill is currently supported by East Bay MUD, as well as East Bay Regional Park District, and passed out of its first policy committee earlier this month. Council has noted in the staff report there are 2 options that the council could pursue with regards to this measure. The first would be for the council not to take a formal position and direct staff to monitor the bill's development and engage with the author's office as appropriate. The second option would be for the council to take a position and, consistent with the council's current legislative policy, for staff to communicate that position to the appropriate entities. Under the second option, the staff recommendation would be a position of support in concept, given that the bill is still in its nascent stages of the policy process, but generally consistent with the council's view that this issue is deserving of additional attention. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to invite once again our executive fellow, Seth Yun, back to the mic. He will be presenting on the second bill, AB 2348. And of course, I'll be available for questions after that.
Great. Welcome back, Seth.
It's good to be back. Thank you, Ryan, and thank you, Council. AB 2348 by Assemblymember Aguiar Curry would add seasonal flooding of rice fields as an eligible activity for funding under the California Department of Fish and Wildlife's California Waterfowl Habitat Program. Currently, the Waterfowl Habitat Program only incentivizes the restoration and management of wetlands, and though wetlands provide quality habitat for waterfowl, the benefits provided by seasonally flooded rice fields are substantial. For example, the Central Valley Joint Venture has estimated that winter-flooded rice fields provide over 60% of the food required by waterfowl in the Sacramento Valley. The Delta Plan encourages the sort of multi-beneficial approach, or this sort of multi-beneficial approach sought in AB 2348 through both policy and recommendation. Delta's A Place Policy 2 requires ecosystem restoration projects, among others, to reduce conflicts with existing land uses. The Delta Plan also recommends that state agencies encourage habitat restoration and wildlife-friendly farming systems on agricultural lands, and both address land subsidence and explore carbon sequestration on state-owned lands in the Delta. All of these activities are possible on flooded rice fields. Finally, the bill is supported by a mix of conservation and agricultural groups and currently enjoys no opposition and passed unanimously out of its first policy committee earlier this week. Similar to the previous measure considered by the Council, this staff report provides two options for the Council to consider. The first is the Council may elect to not take a position, but provide technical assistance to the author's office as appropriate, while the second option would be the Council would take a formal position. That concludes my portion of the presentation, and I would be happy to answer any questions on the bill.
Great. Thank you both. Ken, I expect you have some questions. This was of your doing.
Yes, I know. And I appreciate staff's response and their perseverance in this issue and great analysis of the bills. And I think the fact that there's really no controversy around here and no real organized opposition, in your interpretation, Ryan and Seth, these seems to have broad support, both of these bills.
I would classify they are relatively straightforward bills at this time, given that there are no formally registered opposition to either measure.
Okay. Well, being cognizant of Councilmember Gatto's previous comments about the separation of powers, and I'm over the last year or so, I've become much more attuned to the reasons why there are separations of power, not here in California. I think the reason I have brought this up is I think the legislature is a partner in advancing the co-equal goals. It was the legislature that, created the Delta Reform Act. And I think a lot of the things that we're doing, especially these that are very science program generated opinions, they're furthering our goals. And it's not so much in crafting the legislation, but sending the message of, gee, you're doing a good job here. You're moving this in the right direction. We support what you're doing. Yeah, and, sort of keep it up. And I think these are such foundational activities, harmful algae, converting, rice fields to habitat. I mean, these are the things we want to see done on a much broader scale, and there's probably other things, but I think, we've got a couple appointees from the legislature. I think there is sort of a relationship or a partnership there, and if we can say to these legislators, hey, great idea, we support it, harmful algal task force and waterfowl habitat programs, these are things that advance what we're trying to do. It also raises, it does something with what we're getting out of the science program and brings it into the system where decision makers can make decisions based on these things, on science that we're generating. So that's why, maybe I'll make a motion that that the council takes positions of support on AB 2348 and... Let's see, what's the other one is AB 2053.
Ken, point of clarification, the staff recommendation is support in concept. Is that your motion?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, do we have a second?
I'm going to second that.
Okay, we have a second discussion. Mike and then Susan.
Sure. So I want to pre-explain why I'm going to vote no on this, and that is not just for the process issues I've raised before, but also on the substance. I mean, I don't think it's our place to debate this today, and I don't want to get too deeply into it. But I will note that Governor Brown has vetoed 98, well, in my 7 years in the legislature, Governor Brown vetoed 98 of 100 task force bills. He does not like them. And I disagree with the governor on a lot of things, but I share his, he always writes a veto message that I can probably recite verbatim, which is, if it's important to do a task force, just do it. It doesn't take legislation for government to talk. And I think that's a valid point, and I understand that you might need funding and things like that, but so I'm just playing devil's advocate on that bill. The second bill, the flooding of rice fields, I adore the author. My chief of staff went to work as a chief of staff for the author, and he probably wrote the bill, so nobody tell him that I'm criticizing the bill, but we often hear in Southern California that the flooding of rice fields is the most colossally wasteful thing when it comes to water policy of the state. And so again, on the substance, I just want to explain why I am not going to be supporting this, because I'm often asked to why I voted a certain way. I still think the authors are fighting very important issues, migratory waterfowl and harmful algae, but I'm not going to support this. Thank you.
Okay, Susan.
Mr. Chair.
Ryan, I have a question. In your experience, well, I have a two-part question. The timing question is, when is it most advantageous if we agree with a particular bill to actually express support? And, you know, what are the advantages and disadvantages of doing so at the best time? And I don't know how long you've been with the council, but how many bills has the council supported, and what has been the net result in the, you know, whether the bill is passed or not?
Thank you, Vice Chair Tatine. To your first question, in terms of timing, I think I wouldn't say there's necessarily a perfect time to ever take a position, but in my opinion anyways, I think taking a position earlier when you see an opportunity and a bill that agrees with the interests of your organization and advancing issues that you think are important. I think earlier is better from the standpoint that as the development of legislation moves forward, to have a seat at the table, to be able to provide your feedback and your insight, earlier is better, I think, if you are going to take a position. In terms of, to your second question, I've been at the council, it'll be 3 years in June for me. To my recollection, I don't believe the council has taken a position, a formal position on legislation in that time.
Skip, and then Ken.
Remember, we had this discussion whether or not to even look at it in supporting or opposing legislation. And my argument at the time is that, and I guess I'll rephrase it, you either lead or you follow. And I think if we're the organization, the statewide organization, that wants to lead because we feel strongly about certain issues in the Delta or the statewide issues, then we ought to weigh in early and see if that doesn't prompt others to support the bill as well. So I think it's important that if we truly feel that this legislation and others that will come before us are moving this agenda forward as we see it, then we ought to get on board early and support the legislation.
Ken, and then the judge. Okay, Frank.
Well, who's is this a Ducks Unlimited bill? I mean, what's behind this? I feel a little sandbagged. I have no idea what the value of this would be ultimately.
To which bill are you speaking of, Judge?
The waterfowl bill.
The waterfowl bill. It's an author sponsored bill. So this is not necessarily being sponsored by any one particular organization. It is obviously, its list of supporters are largely conservation-minded and wildlife-friendly organizations. That said, I think as Seth outlined in his presentation, the approach that this bill seeks to incentivize, for lack of a better term, I'd say, is consistent with kind of the multi-benefit way in which the state has tried to move forward in terms of balancing agricultural needs as well as the needs of habitat and the ecosystem as a whole. But to your more pointed question, this is an author carried bill.
Well, I have no particular. I mean, this sounds fine, but I'm a little startled by this comment about that wasting water. I don't know if it is better, the best use of water. Maybe it is. Maybe it isn't. I'm a little concerned that we have no. Maybe Ken is much more into this than I am, but I'm not sure I understand why we would take a position on this.
Ken.
We've been, Ryan and staff have been monitoring this bill for some time, and we've kind of talked about it at previous meetings, and maybe we need to get to Councilmember Gatto's comment on waste and maybe salvage the reputation of your former chief of staff, is that these are part of wetland management plans and done cooperatively with the wildlife agencies. And so it's not in periods of shortage, it's in periods where there's water. And I think, and Skip, you've brought up sort of this issue of you know, the conflict, potential conflict between agricultural land uses and mitigation. This is trying to figure out how can we do both. And I think that's something that we as a council have been encouraging. Is there ways to incentivize or ways to work so that you get this cooperation? And historically, rice farmers have been more open to this. But, again, it's like we want to move these things forward, especially on restoration, water quality, you know. So these are things that are helping accomplish the council's goals. And so I'm just saying that, hey, we should signal that we're supportive of this. And I think you're right, Mike, we can't, do anything that wastes water. But I think that this is structured in a way that it avoids it. And, we've talked a lot about the Yolo bypass. Is this an example of habitat restoration and functional ecosystems and agriculture working together? So it's just like, hey, how do we just like get some momentum going here? And this is just one way to do it. I don't know that we're going to do it much, but when you get something, that moves the ball for us, it seems like we should weigh in. We should say, good job, or, say, well, hey, we think you should do something a different way, because that's our job. So I would hope that we could find a way to at least send the message that you're moving in the right direction.
Yeah, I've observed that Ken has quite an appetite for engaging in legislation. I don't, but I do recognize that these two bills line up nicely with recommendations in the Delta Plan, and that's always been my sideboards. Do the legislative activities support the recommendations and regulations that we have as a body formally approved? And I think these do. Mike, your reference to wasting of water, I don't think you're citing best available science. Just for the council's benefit, years ago, rice stubble was burned, and it created a huge air pollution problem. And I just happened to be in the halls of the legislature the day that the Agricultural Committee passed a bill that ultimately was approved by and signed to ban rice stubble burning. And the alternative to that was to flood rice fields with really very little amount of water required for that. That then they discovered created habitat for wildlife. Mark Reisner, who is very famous for writing Cadillac Desert, was a very outspoken proponent of flooding rice fields for enhancing the flyway for wildlife. And since that time, they are now finding that flooding these rice fields can improve the food web for migrating salmon. So the argument that flooding rice fields is a waste of water is about two decades old and not based on current experience. I'm going to tell you reluctantly, I'm speaking in favor of the motions because of the support in concept. That's why I clarified it. If it was a support position, I couldn't do it because I don't want to tie the hands of our staff to have to monitor these things day by day because legislation can change and what's good today can become very bad tomorrow. So I think by taking a support in concept position, it provides Ryan the opportunity to become a technical advisor to the authors and the committees that are going to be dealing with these bills, gains us a place at the table. It elevates the issues that we think are important. So again, reluctantly, I'm speaking in favor of taking a position on legislation.
Are you saying you support the concept or you support these specific bills? I don't understand that.
Well,
fund the rice fields, and we should.
We should.
We're all for that, but I mean,
exactly.
Here's my problem with this.
Exactly.
If you want to see the concept, I can buy that. But this sounds like a chit chat over the back fence. I mean, you know, we don't know squat about it. I don't know anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
Bill, and I don't like the idea of saying I'm for this numbered bill because we ought to do it. That's not good enough. We should take measured positions based upon scientific-based background and information and recommendations of that nature. I don't think we should be just supporting bills. I mean, the concept is fine. I don't. That's what you're talking about,
yeah.
Mr. Chair. I have no problem with that, but I think we should be careful about
that is the motion, and,
okay.
And I would reluctantly support because support and concept doesn't tie our hands. It doesn't bind us. The bill changes, Ryan will advise us, and if we need to take a stronger position, we can. Ryan, explain what support and concept means to you and how it would direct you any differently than what you would ordinarily do in response to bills like this.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the idea behind support and concept is an acknowledgement that it is relatively early still in the legislative process, and the development of this bill, as many other pieces of legislation, continues to evolve. So I would anticipate that both bills presented today are in their early stages, and certainly, as Mr. Gatto is well aware, could evolve and morph over time. The concept that both bills seek to address is consistent with the Delta Plan, the policies and recommendations, and the approach there. That said, any position taken by the council is obviously a representation of how the body feels at a particular point in time in response to a particular version of the bill. Should as it evolves over time, obviously, you know, my role here would be to keep the council apprised of those developments, and certainly the council could revisit its position at any time going forward.
Clarify my motion for the record is that on the two bills, 2053 and 2348, move to accept the staff recommendation option two, which is to support in concept.
Support in concept. Ryan, as a practical matter, does this action alter the engagement that you would have at the staff level in the legislature?
Mr. Chair, I think the primary difference that taking a more formal position like this would be is a representation of the council's feeling about a particular measure to the public. So testifying before committees, submitting formal position letters, that would be largely the impact that a actual position would have in my mind.
Okay, so it will elevate the level of activity.
Yes, it would.
Okay, all right. All right, any other comments or questions on the motion? Ready for the vote? Okay, Ken?
Weinberg, aye.
Demmel, aye.
Gatto, no.
Tatayan, aye.
Fiorini, aye.
Maranian, aye.
Thompson, aye.
Let the record show Thompson won.
Thank you, Randy. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you both very much. Okay.
All right. Thank you. So on to our quarterly contract update. This information is in your binder. We include it every quarter. We are reaching the end of the fiscal year, so we are doing a lot of number crunching and looking at our contracts and end of year information. So if you have any questions about that quarterly contract update, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, if there are no questions, I'd like to move on to approval of several contracts. So there are three contracts up for approval, and either I can go through all of them or I can go through them one by one. Is there a preference?
Yeah, let's go through all of
them. Go through all of them. Okay. So there's three. So the first is approval of the Association of Bay Area Governments, ABAG, contract with them. We're requesting council approval for a contract amendment that would extend the term of the agreement from 2018 to 2020. And the agreement would increase the current budget by $100,000, raising the total to $951,000. The second contract is approval of U.S. Geological Survey, USGS, Sacramento Operation Baseline Contract, and this would be an amendment. So staff is requesting that we approve the contract amendment for the Operation Baseline Studies. The amendment would extend the term of the agreement from June 30th, 2018 to June 30th, 2020, and increase the current budget by $251,800, raising the total to $848,000. The third contract for approval is with the University of California, Davis, and it's on a telemetry research contract. This is also an amendment. And we are recommending approval of the amendment for a time extension from June 30th, 2018 to December 31st, 2019, and that would increase the current budget by $250,000 to a total of $1,750,000.
Questions of Jessica? Would someone care to offer?
I move approval.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second to amend the three contracts. That your intent, all three?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, good. That's the motion. Any discussion? All right, ready?
Weinberg, aye.
Demmel, aye.
Gatto, aye.
Tatayan, aye.
Fiorini, aye.
Maranian, aye.
Thompson, aye.
Motion passes unanimously. Let the record show. Skip 1-1. All right.
Good day. He's on a streak.
Thank you, colleagues.
Okay. Anything else?
That's
on
it.
File
Thank you,
item
council members.
Thank you, Jessica.
That concludes the executive officer report. Yep.
Those amendments represent a lot of work, so thanks for bringing those to us. File item number 9, lead scientist report, Dr. John Calloway. Oh.
One tiny last thing on file number 8, and that is on behalf of the council, and I'm sure everybody feels the same way, I want to thank Jessica Law for working her butt off and working so hard and so effectively in the absence of Jessica Pearson. And you have been a just tremendous interim executive officer, and I just want to thank you for that.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it. Jessica will be back in this seat next month, and I won't disappear. Okay.
Wait. You're applauding after she said she's going to disappear. Okay. Won't disappear. Okay, you want to? Okay, in that case. All right. Well, I got to get my hearing aid tuned up. Okay, on to file item number 9. John?
Okay, so First, before I talk about the items that are in your binder, as you recall, last month I gave an overview of the ballast water study and the feasibility of onshore ballast water treatment, and we had received the executive summary last month. Since that update last month, we've received the full report, and we have transferred the full report onto the State Lands Committee, so that really concludes that that project for our staff. So any questions on that item? Okay, so today I have two articles that I wanted to give you an update on, and then two other short items. So the first article is called Estuary Ecosystem Restoration, Implementing and Institutionalizing Adaptive Management. It just came out very recently in the journal Restoration Ecology, and it focuses on adaptive management issues in the Columbia River estuary, and it highlights a 10-year effort to institutionalize or really incorporate adaptive management directly into the issues there in the Columbia River, and it has many parallels with work that is ongoing here in the Sacramento Delta, and so I wanted to highlight just really what's most interesting is the similar approaches between what we're doing and what they're doing. And so I think I'll just highlight some of those issues. One thing that many people say is that adaptive management is easy to talk about and easy to think about, but really a challenge to implement. And so they're trying to highlight how they've been successful in implementing it. As I mentioned, it's the Columbia River Estuary up in Oregon, on the Oregon-Washington border. The two main agencies that are involved in this work are both federal agencies, the Army Corps of Engineers and the Bonneville Power Administration. I think it's probably a simpler issue or a simpler management issue than we have here because it really focuses mostly on restoration. So they have dams and they have water, the hydroelectric power and water use issues, but all upstream. And so there isn't the issue of moving water through the delta, through the system as the challenges that we have here. I also wanted to just highlight, in terms of the goals of their actual restoration program, how similar they are to the restoration goals that we have here. So they're focusing on identifying primary stressors to the ecosystem, identifying and or conserving and restoring factors that improve ecosystem processes and ecosystem functions, increasing the quantity and quality of ecosystem habitat and ecosystem available specifically for salmonids, for juvenile salmonids, maintaining and enhancing estuarine food webs to support salmonids, and improving the survivorship of salmonids and improving understanding of their life history as they move through the estuary. So very, very similar, but much more narrow than the challenging issues that we have here. We don't have just salmon. We have other species and many other challenging issues. But what they highlight are the things that I think we already are aware of here, that in order for a project to be successful, it has to be implementable and cost-effective. It has to focus on collaboration. It has to be science-based. And the specific ideas, the specific recommendations that they have, the elements that are most important to adaptive management implementation that they highlight are, in order for the project, for that broader adaptive management program to be successful, there has to be buy-in to a common goal amongst the agencies. And so there's those two lead agencies, but as here, there are at least 10 or 15 other federal and state agencies involved. So they've worked long and hard initially to develop common goals. They've established and implement a governance structure and decision-making structure. So they really highlight how they've put together a very focused decision-making process that really focuses on those two lead agencies about how decisions are made about restoration, how restoration projects are prioritized. They emphasize sharing data and information, so you heard about the efforts here, and that's definitely something they're aware of as well. They focus on coordination and communication issues, the need to get early buy-in to the adaptive management process through across the agencies. They emphasize embracing independent scientific peer review, just as we do here, resolving conflicts and cooperating with agencies in a constructive way and avoiding those contentious issues and focusing on conflict resolution, And then they emphasized the need to really be dedicated and put funding into implementing adaptive management. So I think the interesting thing is really the commonality that of what they found and what we've found. The effort there is a little bit smaller, but similar to here. So they're over the last 5 or 6 years, they've restored 3,700 acres of habitat and acquired 2,500 acres. So it is definitely a large-scale effort and probably one of the larger-scale efforts on the Pacific Coast, analogous to what we have here. So any questions or comments on that article? Okay, so then the second article is a completely different topic, but I think one that's very relevant and very interesting. The title is Endangered Winter Run Chinook Salmon Rely on Diverse Rearing Habitats in a Highly Altered Landscape. This the lead author is Corey Phyllis at the Metropolitan Water District. He started this work when he was a student at UC Davis, and actually it was funded by CalFed and the science program when it initially started. The Metropolitan Water District carried on the funding so that Corey could spend time on data analysis. And Rachel Johnson, who works at NOAA, or National Marine Fisheries, is also one of the other co-authors, and then other faculty from Davis and Lawrence Livermore Lab. So the challenging issue around this study was to understand where salmon are spending the early part of their life history. And so we've talked before about telemetry studies where you tag fish and see where they're moving. But really, all of those stations are on the main stem of the river, and so you can see where they're moving within the river, but you don't know if they're using other areas outside the main stem of the Sacramento. And so what this study was done was to evaluate, are the fish only in the Sacramento as they move down the winter run, or are they moving out into other areas? And they used a really interesting approach here where they used the otolith, the ear, the tiny little bone that floats in the ear of fish. They looked at it at like a tree ring where you could see it as the fish grows, the otolith grows. And so what they did was they looked at the chemical composition of the individual tiny little rings on that otolith, and they looked at a particular isotope that would be characteristic, have a signature or identify different river stretches or different tributaries into the Sacramento. So it's a unusual approach, but really amazing. So they use a tiny little laser and they shave off bits of the otolith. And not only are they just looking at the whole otolith, they're looking at rings so they can see over time, over the age of the fish, where has it spent its time. And so they collected those otolith samples over a 3-year period. Actually, they were collected back, I think, in 2007, 8, and 9, so you can see how long of a time it actually took. It's intensive lab work, and then it was also an extended period for them to complete the results. So they looked at these at strontium isotopes, and by looking at the there's different naturally occurring isotopes of strontium that are characteristic of the watershed where the water is coming from. And so what they were able to identify was that about 50% of the fish on average spend at least a third of their time moving down the river in other tributaries. So they go up the Feather River, they go up some of the rivers up in the Lassen area, or they go up the American River, or they spend extended time here in the Delta. And so really the amazing thing is that they were able to show it's not just the Sacramento River that's important for these juvenile fish. It's some of these tributaries that we haven't really focused on. And so restoration work in the tributaries could have some significant benefits, as well as restoration or management of conditions right on the main stem of the Sacramento. So like I said, they found, I think it varied from 44 to 63% of the juveniles spent at least 3 weeks off the main river in these alternative habitats. So I think it's some, interesting sort of preliminary findings, but really could have some important implications. Any thoughts or questions?
John, so the tributary habitats, are they more degraded, less degraded, or is it the challenge of getting to those tributaries? How would you apply this?
I think it depends. So I'm sure there are some areas that are less degraded, and it's just that as they're moving down, rather than moving straight down or slowing down in Sacramento, they're heading up some of these other areas. And it just identifies that there's these real opportunities. If we maybe we just as much as trying to improve conditions on the main stem, putting some efforts into those other areas, not way, way upstream. These are pretty, they're small fish, so they're just really moving, you know.
Left or right.
Yeah.
Off the main stem.
Yeah.
Okay. So food web concerns in those areas, is that sort of like letting the juveniles mature and be strengthened while before they head back out?
Exactly. So they didn't find any difference in size of the otolith. So what they could do is they could see when did the fish leave from freshwater into the estuarine part of the system. They didn't find that fish were necessarily bigger if they spent time out there, but they weren't smaller either. So they're doing just as well on these small tributaries as they are on the main stem. Any other questions? Okay, so then the last two items are very brief items to update you on. One is the salmon disease ecology workshop that I'd mentioned previously, and that occurred in the middle of March. It was actually a two-day, it was a combination symposium and workshop. So the first day was a series of about 15 presentations that was open to the public. And then the second day was a workshop with the presenters and other local experts really discussing what some of the implications of those findings are and how their findings could be incorporated into management issues here. I think really the general lesson was we're sort of behind in terms of incorporating studies on salmon disease and evaluating that as a critical factor. And work from the Klamath River, the Columbia River, from British Columbia, from Ireland was all presented to show what kinds of monitoring, what kinds of evaluations are being done to get a better understanding of salmon disease ecology. For juveniles as well as for adults. And that came from both hatchery work, from wild runs fish, as well as from aquaculture. And so I think there were a number of recommendations about how we might incorporate some of the work that's been done in those other areas to improve monitoring of fish. The one fact that I will mention was that in the Columbia River Basin, where there's been a long history of following the disease issues, they show that fish that are undiseased have four and a half times higher chance of returning as adults than diseased fish. So it clearly could have some significant population effects. Okay, and then the last item to talk about is the IEP workshop that occurred in early March. And as I've mentioned previously, and you've heard from Steve Culberson, the lead scientist of the IEP, you know that the IEP does enormous amount of monitoring throughout the Delta and throughout the estuary. And this is their annual three-day workshop to inform both scientists locally as well as managers what some of the current findings are. And second to the Bay Delta Science Conference is probably the biggest local science conference focusing on the Delta. And some of the themes that I highlighted in the summary there are the importance of science communication. It was really emphasized that scientists need to do a much better job communicating their findings to managers and decision makers so that science is incorporated in decision making. On the other hand, decision makers need to do a better job of identifying critical management questions so that can direct where some of the science is going. And there was a lot of talk about how we can do that more effectively. A second theme was that in addition to just understanding population dynamics of smelt or salmon or other species of interest, we need to really get at more of the driving factors that are causing some of these, the mechanisms that are causing changes in population dynamics. And then there was a lot of interest in improving synthesis efforts within IEP. So an enormous amount of data is collected, but there's the scientists and the staff are so busy collecting the data that there's not so much of an opportunity for them to use time to go back and look at long-term trends or other factors that that would give some of the insight that is important. And so there was a lot of interest in figuring out how to get more resources and more time for staff to put efforts into synthesis. So those are some of the general themes. Some of the key issues that were presented, there was a number of presentations around drought impacts and lessons from the drought. There were food web studies. There was a session focusing on nutrient issues, and Operation Baseline was a part of that. The ISB participated. There was an overview of the ISB work. Joy Zedler presented. The first time they've had a session on social science issues, and she presented on traditional ecological knowledge. And then Tracy Collier actually closed out the whole meeting and gave a really nice overview of the challenges of maintaining a long-term monitoring system, lessons from research that's been done in Australia and how we might learn from that here in the Delta. So, any questions on that IEP workshop?
Any questions? No.
Okay, so I will turn it over to Nir Oxenberg, and Nir has been filling in.
Mr. Chair, yes. Before we go on to the numbers, Dr. Calloway, I've been asked to ask you if there's an interagency modeling steering committee.
Yes.
Would there be any ability to add someone onto that?
Yeah, I don't
Richard
see a problem.
Denton. I don't know if you know Richard Denton.
No, I don't.
He's a hydrologist modeler, and he has indicated an interest in serving on that subcommittee. So could I have him contact
me, and we can see about that.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Sure. So, yeah, I'll hand it over to Nir Oxenberg, and Nir's going to present by the numbers. Nir's been presenting for the last, this is his third month. We've had a lapse in the Sea Grant Fellows. As you heard, Amanda Wasserman, who's here, is our new Sea Grant Fellow. And as Jessica said, we're giving her a little bit of a slow introduction. Next month, she'll be here to present by the numbers. So I'll turn it over to Nir.
Good afternoon, council members. I'm going to keep this brief, just touching on some key points. We'll start with precipitation. Following a very wet March, we still got some precipitation in April. We are now at 83% of our average to date for the Northern Sierra. This is the highest percent we have been at all water year. For comparison, we were at 74% precipitation to date at the end of last month in the Northern Sierra. However, if we look at snowpack, it becomes clear that the gains in precipitation fall mostly as rain. The snowpack has decreased from last month, especially in the Northern Sierra. Last month, we were at 42% of average of snowpack, and this month, we're at 24% of average. With regards to water supply, the snowmelt, along with the rain, have maintained reservoir storage at average levels, and Oroville is continuing to fill up. Again, due to snowmelt and rain, water flows in the Sacramento and San Joaquin Rivers have increased drastically from last month. For example, the average flow of the Sacramento River this month is over 41,000 cubic feet per second. To put that in perspective, it would take just over 2 seconds to a flow from the Sacramento River to fill an Olympic-sized swimming pool. Last month, you would have had to wait over 5 seconds. At this time last year, flows were even higher. You would have had your pool fill in just 1.3 seconds. Salinity levels are lower this month compared to last, in part due to the higher flows. With regards to fish, I'll start by talking about the spring Kodiak trawl. The spring Kodiak trawl is a fish survey that determines the relative abundance and distribution of Delta smelt, specifically spawning Delta smelt. The spring Kodiak trawl samples 40 stations each month from January through May. This month, zero Delta smelt were caught, meaning that we remain at 15 caught for the year. The long-term catches graph exemplifies this record low year. I don't even know if you can see it on the screen. The 15. Okay, you have it in front of you. Great. As you may know, I prefer ending on a more positive note, so I will briefly describe that during the 2017-2018 season, over 10,000 steelhead have returned to the Coleman Hatchery, which is about 30 miles south of the Shasta Dam. The previous record in the past 10 years was about 3,600 steelhead during the 2014-2015 season. Without going into details, I'll just say that this was a successful year for the hatchery's conservation effort and welcome news for anglers. That concludes my report.
Thank you, Nir. Any questions? Those look like happy fish in that picture.
Yeah. Those are happy fish.
Happy they're not smelt.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Amanda, you can see you've got a tough act to follow. Yeah. Okay. Anything else, John?
That's it. Thank you. Thank you very much, Nir, for filling in for those 3 months and really doing a great job. Nir is our communication specialist, and you can see that he really thinks and does a great job getting that information across.
Yes, he does. Next item, file item number 10. This is an opportunity for anybody in the public to comment on anything they wish. I'll take the opportunity to echo Mike Gatto's appreciation of Jessica Law. When Jessica Pearson was leaving to go on maternity leave, she gave Jessica Law and myself each a list and said, I want to make sure that you stay focused and get these things done. And her last comment to me was, this will be good for J-Law. And I just want to attest, it's been a privilege to get to work with Jessica. She has done an amazing job. I've seen her grow in her skills and her talents, and I'm glad that you are not going to disappear. Okay, good. So thank you. I think that concludes the agenda. Thank you all for coming. This meeting is adjourned.